Buenas tardes a todos. Bienvenidos nuevamente a la experiencia podcast Go See Talk. El día de hoy tenemos el honor de dar la vivienda a nuestro escritor invitado. Recibamos con un fuerte aplauso a Federico Furzán.
Muchas gracias, Mark. Estoy muy feliz de estar acá contigo.
Muchas gracias. Well, welcome to the podcast. Welcome to the website. We are excited to have Federico on our team. He's been kicking butt. He's already got a name for himself in the writing community. He's a Rotten Tomatoes approved critic, which is no small task. So we are thrilled to be speaking with you. And like I said, thanks for joining the team. So how's your week been going now that it's the weekend?
My weekend's been great. I've been resting a little bit. I haven't seen much movies. Normally my Fridays, what I do is I just try to go on YouTube and, you know, surf around some documentaries about film. That's what I've been doing lately on Fridays. And I normally catch up on Saturdays and Sundays on films that are on my list. I try to prepare lists during the week for films that I will see on the weekend. And that's about it. I didn't see any films today. I'm planning to see Stalker late tonight. I wanted to see that from a long time ago and haven't had time. It's a very long movie and I know I'm gonna require a lot of concentration to watch it. I know it's not an easy film to watch. And thank you for the welcome. I'm very glad to be part of the Go See Talk team. I'm gonna mention this because I know we haven't spoken about it, but what I found very interesting about the site was that you gave a lot of importance to film scores. And I've always been a film score buff. I actually work out listening to soundtracks and I write listening to soundtracks and I try to work listening to soundtracks. And that, it blew my mind because there are no film sites like that. And I got around to reading what you do on what you write about film scores, and I found it very interesting. I hadn't mentioned that to you, but I just wanted to point it out.
Well, no, I appreciate that very much. I like to think that that's one of the elements that sets us apart from other blogs, because I think what's important about writing is you write to what is what you're passionate about, and like you said, if listening to film scores occupies that much of your time, I think that it's, I think you and I are of the same breed, and it's good to be speaking with you on that note. And because of that, there are a good number of people in the world who write about film and are film music and focus on composers. We're a kind of a small niche, but we're all very emotional and invested in it. So glad to have you jumping on the bandwagon with us. So maybe on that note, what have you been listening to lately? What's been helping you get through some bench presses or some heavy writing assignments?
I like to watch horror films most of all. I've been trying to stay away from those because I've been paying a lot of attention to indie films, and there are not a lot of horror indie films. And what I try to listen to when I write is something that's not very percussive, but it's more like an ambience style of soundtrack. So I've been listening to a lot of horror soundtracks that are based in ambience. I have a favorite of mine that's on every playlist that I've put together on Spotify, and that's the Sinister soundtrack, which has a lot of different musicians from Lost Moore to Christopher Young. I like that. And I've also found horror synth to be very, very fun. I like this band. I don't know if it's a band. I don't research on things like that. I'm sorry. But I like this band that's called Perturbator. That's absolutely great. I press the play button and I think this the Spotify algorithm takes me through different bands that sound alike. But I just like getting the moment with that kind of soundtrack.
Okay, no, that's real cool. That's real cool. I know who they are. I don't know that much about them except that they are kind of heavy. There's an independent music website or platform called Bandcamp. And I've been going for a number of years down sort of synth rabbit holes, from DAD to Vanilla to Arcade Summer to Highway Superstar. And then I kind of fell on, I can't say their name.
Perturbator?
Perturbator. Okay, yes. And every now and then I'll find myself kind of flowing between them or maybe Carpenter Brute, but I don't have a whole lot of experience, but go on, you know, because when you speak Christopher Young, he's one of the titans of the horror music community, and and a bunch of other styles that he can do. Like I think he did Swordfish, which was I don't think that movie gets enough love. It's a Warner Brothers movie from I think 2000 with Hugh Jackman and John Travolta, but he did the music on that as well. But go on.
I actually don't remember Swordfish score. I know that it has a lot of like techno music, because of the whole technology things going that's going around in the movie. I don't remember that score in particular. I like him because I think that he puts together the 80s and the 90s. Very well, and I like how he can go through different eras, and he stays within his essence of his writing. I like that he does his like dense music. It's very like thick music. Mm-hmm. I don't know a lot of music terminology, but that's why I probably hesitate a bit, but I like how he uses like heavy strings in the back. I like that in film scores.
Gotcha. Yeah, there's one I've been meaning to check out. It is a Brandon Cronenberg's movie called Possessor.
And I think that's a great film.
Well, then I will put it even higher on my list of to sees. But I think that I think it's Jim Williams. I think he is the composer who did that. And Mondo released an album, a vinyl release of that score. And so sometimes what I love to do is I love to listen to music before I go into a movie. So especially if there was going to be an interview opportunity to speak to a composer, sometimes what I'll do is have a listen to the soundtrack 2 or 3 times, get a feel for the score, and then that way I can pick up on it a little more during the movie. But this one I was hesitant to dive into. I wanted to sort of jump into Possessor all in one sitting. But so what do you think about it? What are your thoughts?
I watched Possessor I think it was one year ago because I got a screener, and one thing I remember is that the sound of the screener was not very good. Mm. It was unfortunate because I like what Brandon Cronenberg does with his films. It's like he gets you in and you're like forced to stay inside something that you don't necessarily want to be inside. So I really wanted to get the feel of the sound of the movie. But I think that just the visuals are enough. Okay, that's a very weird film. And the fun thing about it is that at the end, it all makes sense. Okay, if you connect with the story from the beginning, at the end, it makes sense. And that doesn't happen a lot with films that go into this dystopian nature of things to come. And what I loved about that film is that it plays well. It's not, it's very violent, of course. But everything happens for a reason, and there's nothing like that you can remove from the film. It's a perfect film just like it is. I mean, not a perfect film, because I think that a perfect film would be Raiders of the Lost Ark. That's a perfect film. This one is just a very unique film. I mean, we don't see films like that. That's what I appreciate about Brandon Cronenberg and his whole agenda of films, because you know that he's gonna go further in his field.
Well, if you come from, you know, his first film was called Antiviral,
yeah,
which was as far as how impressive it was for taking a concept like people's desire and affinity to be close to celebrity, or the sort of infatuation with famous people, taking that to the next level of, well, it's not just enough to see a paparazzi picture of them or see them on the news all the time, but to a point where, as gross as this is, you want to, you know, share the same disease. If they got sick, just share the same disease they have, or even sort of even grosser, ingest and digest them. It's like, but you know, that's the Cronenberg legacy, is the sort of body amorphication, or I'm not sure that's the right term, but just the way you can sort of take something to an extreme. And I think it's a well done movie. It's a little tough on the first take, and even on the second take, but if this is the next evolution in his storytelling, then kind of like what you said, may not be perfect film, but the things that directors like him do, you can do everything perfect and it may still not result in being a perfect film, but still there's a professionalism and, you know, that you can raise the bar, so to speak, by giving just a real quality output. So, I'm excited to check it out. That sounds amazing. Let's go back in time and find out about a young Federico and what got you into the world of cinema.
Well, I was born in 1982 in a very small town in Venezuela. We only had one movie theater, and they played the same movie for 1 week. So my contact with cinema was more in my household, because my father, even though he's a doctor, he was always into cinema. And I vividly remember telling me to watch films and to go beyond what I saw initially on the screen. I know that we had VHS tapes, of course. And that's how I got into it. He always told me, said the same words, go beyond the screen. There's someone that's doing this and you have to understand why he's doing it. Films were like a religion back home. And even though we had one movie theater, we went to that movie theater every single week. Sometimes we had a special like screening on Tuesday of a classic film, and we went as well. But I mostly remember watching films at home with my dad. Even though he's a doctor, I insist, he also wrote about films in a local newspaper.
Oh, cool.
And I guess that I always wanted to be like him, because I think that he's the smartest man I've ever known, and I admire him a lot. And that's just how I got started. I remember having a little journal and transcribing reviews in Spanish, of course, from books that my dad had. He had like 3 or 4 books on Roger Ebert. And I just transcribed those reviews in Spanish and like thought I was reviewing those films myself. That's how I started. And I know, like 15 years after, I started blogging. And of course, my first reviews were not as serious as they are today. They're crap, and I we wanted to erase them from the internet. I know it's not possible, but at the same time, I'm very proud that I got started somewhere, and today I'm like a better version of that person. That's how I started.
Well, that's great. What movies do you and your father both hold dear? Maybe do you have three of them, or do you maybe remember one you watch so frequently you can sort of quote it at any given day?
I remember watching the intro for Vertigo, for Hitchcock's Vertigo, because he had a VHS tape, and I remember that every time he showered and he was like putting on his clothes after, he put on Vertigo's tape. And so that those first 5 or 10 minutes, I know them by heart. I also remember Close Encounters, of course. It actually became my favorite movie ever. And I remember seeing that with him, and he always told me that he when he saw Close Encounters for the first time in a movie theater. And curiously, it's one of the few movies that I like so much that I haven't seen in a movie theater. And that was when I was small, but he gave me even though he insisted that I watch films, he also insisted that I had to make up my own mind on my favorite films. I remember I read an article like 2 months ago about my experience when my dad had traveled to the States, and he brought me a tape of the Texas Chainsaw Massacre. And I remember watching the film and how it marked me, even though it was a very lousy version of a tape. I just remember thanking him for that approach, that I could see whatever I want. And on that trip, he brought home The Exorcist. And I hadn't seen The Exorcist in this uncut version ever. I hadn't seen the masturbation scene ever. And that's I saw that for the very first time. And I also remember
at what age, I'm sorry, I missed the part. How young were you when you saw both of these?
I must have been like 13, 12 or 13, because that was like 94, 95. I was 15, no, 13, I was 13 years old, because that was the same year that I went to the States for the first time. That was 95, yeah.
Okay. Well, no, please continue, because I also have a little bit of a history of watching movies way before my time, but they sort of not to say make a man out of you, but I think they just sort of help define your tastes growing up and give you an idea of sort of how deep the film rabbit hole can go. But no, please keep going.
Yeah, I think that one of my I have like three or four memories that I remember very vividly on films. I remember the when I watched the trailer for the Blair Witch Project. I was graduating high school that day, and of course, the internet service was like, I don't know, it was really, really crappy, and I think that I saw it on a 1-inch screen, the trailer for the Blair Witch. But when I saw that trailer, I knew that film will become important. And I told my dad that we have to go see this movie in the States, because some film did not arrive to Venezuela, okay? We didn't have the same access. So I was like certain that I wasn't going to watch that film in the theater. And we actually went to the States in 99 we had a family trip, but one of the hidden objectives on our agenda, my dad and I, was to go watch the Blair Witch Project. And I remember going out of the theater and feeling like there was this important event that we were part of, and I'll always thank him for that, because he has the same vision that I have on films. Now I want to hear how you got to connect with the whole film scores of movies. What was the first film score that you heard that made you fall in love with that particular element in film?
What really got me into film scores was Alan Silvestri's Back to the Future, because it was probably around 1987. That the film came out in 85. I saw it on VHS in 87, and I was 7 at the time, and I started to understand the importance of the auditory experience and how that added to it, especially the climax of the movie when Marty's trying to get back to the future and the lightning storm and Doc's on the clock tower, just all that coming together. And I started to now notice that the music was timed to certain sequences in the movie. And I didn't really understand that until a number of years later, when I was listening to Star Wars and doing my homework to it. And I remember having a conversation with my dad, and I didn't understand the difference between a soundtrack and as far as score and needle drop or music selections, because I thought that they just found score the same way as they found needle drop or source music. And I said, Dad, how does this music work so well? How does the end of the Star Wars movie, when Luke blows up the Death Star, how do they find that music that perfectly times to the action? He goes, they write it for the action. And it just, took my little mind to another level, going, wait, somebody actually, there's composing, I had to step a second to process it. And then ever since then, I just, everything I did was in always paying attention to who the composer was or who the orchestrator was and scores in general. So it's been a big part of my life. I feel like it's at times more important to me than the movie itself, because sometimes I'll buy a soundtrack for a movie that I will never see again, or one that's maybe utter crap, but there's always something of value in the movie music. So that's kind of a long answer to your question.
Do you have a favorite film score?
I think I do. The Rocketeer is way up there. There's something that James Horner did with that sort of, it's an underrated comic book adaptation and just a fun, kooky movie any day of the week. But between The Rocketeer, Gladiator, and Rocky, those are kind of what I think film music is to me. Those sort of fun, I find themselves just revisiting those over and over and over. How about you?
I think E.T. is my favorite film score of all time.
Wow! But yeah,
I think that what John Williams has, we know he's a pioneer of the whole film music industry, but what I like about John Williams and what I think that a few others have tried to make and they haven't even got close to him is that he writes themes, and that's the whole difference between, like, for example, John Williams and Hans Zimmer, that John Williams writes themes, and we don't listen to themes anymore in film music. That's what I like about him. And I like that in every one of his iconic film scores, he doesn't have one theme. He has two themes. And he always puts them together, like, very emotionally in the film. Whenever I listen to the E.T. soundtrack, I feel like I am in the movie. I mean, it's a very special film for me, but I think that it's a mix of having grown up in the 80s and knowing that it was a very big deal back then. That's my favorite film score. But I have a question for you. Is there a movie that you don't like, but whose film score you love?
I have two of them. The first one is probably, and not to say I love, but it's just something that pops into my head as in it's great music, but it just doesn't really do anything for the movie. It's James Newton Howard's After Earth score. I think what he did for that movie is he just gave it a, I just have this weird assumption that James Newton Howard never watches the film. Like he just, I mean, he has a great relationship with directors like M. Night Shyamalan and Paul Greengrass, but I just feel like there's something he gives a movie that lets it live on its own, to the point where the movie might just not do anything, but he doesn't care. You know, he's just going to let it, he's going to take it to, he's going to write a suite and try to put his DNA all over it and make it fantastic. But the other one I think I would say is probably Beyond the Black Rainbow, which I've watched that movie 3 times. I still don't know what's happening. It's sort of a overblown.
No one does. Don't worry. No one does what's going on there.
Okay, great. But the music, it's propulsive. It sort of gets under your skin. Not in a horror music kind of way, but it just, it's such an obscure but original sound, and I just love it. So yeah, and I have others, but I think those are the two that always sort of pop in my head. And thing is, I can listen to them anytime I want, you know. And I will never have to watch the movie again. So that's fun. How about you? That's a good question.
I'm trying to think of one. A movie that I don't love, but whose film score I like. There's this thing that if the movie doesn't do like anything for me, I will probably I won't pay attention to its score.
Okay.
It's kind of weird, but today there are some films that I remember because of their score, and I try to revisit those films because of the score, and they work better than the first time. So it's kind of cheating. I totally agree with what you say about James Newton Howard, because I always listen to his scores, but only from the Shyamalan era, to say something like that.
Okay.
I love his score for The Village. I think that was great, but it doesn't connect with the movie itself. And I love that film. No matter what everyone says, I actually love that film and the film's twist. I have an experience with Newton Howard, because I remember the first time that I saw Signs in the movie theater. I remember that the theater was packed. It was opening night. It was packed because everyone knew who the director was. Everyone knew who the actors were. And in that film, the first thing that you hear is the score. And the screen, it's pitch black. And when that score begins, that's like film magic right there. And I love that score. I love the film as well, but it wouldn't be the same without James Newton Howard doing that job. And in exploring his career, I remember revisiting the score for Sixth Sense, because I remember watching the film the first time. I was terrified and I didn't pay attention to its score. And when I saw it like 10 years after that, I cannot understand why the sound mix of the film sets the film score so low. I actually don't understand why he did that. I mean, he must have had some reason, and it worked well, but I would have loved to listen more to that score during the film.
Sure. And I think, you know, that those are almost two opposite ends of the spectrum experiences. You know, when you mentioned Signs, you're almost hit over the head with a sledgehammer with the opening credits to Signs. Where, you know, the very heavy strings just overpower you, and then it just goes kind of silent after that. But the converse side of that is Sixth Sense. It's completely understated. And I think there's only something close to 30 minutes of music in the movie. So it's very selective because it doesn't want to take your attention. Something like, like when Hans Zimmer did 12 Years a Slave, his mandate or his directive to himself was to stay out of the way of the story. So it's great music all around, but you're right. Signs would not be anything without that music, especially that sort of turn at the end. It goes from very emotional, very action heavy. Then it turns to the flashback, and then it goes to, Mel Gibson's son having an asthma attack out in the field. And it's just, the ability to turn on a dime like that and change tones and almost musical genres, it's masterful. So I'm glad you brought that up, because that's one of my dear favorites. And I just, every time I start it, I can't stop until it's through, especially when you get to the last couple tracks, Hand of Fate, Part 1 and 2. Man, it's just, whew. That's why we love film scores, right?
Yeah. I think this is turning more into a conversation about film scores, and I'm not ashamed to say that that's the direction I wanted to go.
Well, then I think you set this ship on the right course. I think we're headed where we want to go. Way to go! Way to pull it, M. Night Shyamalan. take the films, the podcast out from under me, and you drive the boat. Anyway.
Yeah. I like his early films. Up until the last Airbender, I loved his films. And I'm curious to know why he does great things, and he has the capacity of disabling himself. I cannot understand why he does things like, The Village, which I love, and then he does things like Glass, which I absolutely despise as a film.
Okay.
I cannot understand why he does that. I mean, I think he's a very original director, and I appreciate how his input of creativity is still appreciated to some point in the industry, but I cannot understand why he does what he does. I mean, After Earth is a shameful picture. I'm sorry, it doesn't work for me. But when he watched the final product, I mean, he has to sit down and say, "I could have done something better than this." Come on. Mm-hmm. I have a question for you.
Pregúntalo.
Okay. Is there any film composer, is there any classic film composer that you don't like? I'm something in the lines of Howard Shore or something like that.
If I answer yes to any composer, I'm pretty sure they'll take my film score appreciation card away. No, I don't think there's anybody I don't take to. I think one of the, this is going to be a very political answer, but I think that, like any creative industry, these people work really hard to create, contribute to a project. It's not like they're writing this music out of their own head with no basis or no frame of reference. It's not like they're writing something for a symphony hall. I mean, they're contributing. Just like the lighting department contributes lighting to the film, like the wardrobe department contributes something to this vision. I think they're all sort of a cog in a machine, and they all have to work. So I feel like, since they are in a collaborative effort, it's less about them and it's more about the greater good. So I guess that's okay. Why I'm kind of saying that I don't feel like there's anybody I don't take to, because I feel that even though it's their music, technically not their music, if you think about it, you know, because they're usually given a you know, some suggestions like this needs to be big, or the guy needs to be a hero here, or the bad guy needs to. So they're sort of being told what to do. Now, you think of somebody like James Newton Howard, or maybe even Hans Zimmer, they lay such an acoustic blanket that they sort of get to do what they want. But other composers, they're kind of just sort of filling the vision of the director. And I know everything I said is very general and generic, but I feel like we don't really get a chance to know what composers would do with something, because they're always tied to a project. So it's kind of a tough question to answer. But I guess succinctly, I'll say that no, I don't think there's anybody out there that I just go, you know what, I don't like them. You know, whether it's their use of melodies or a penchant for using a particular instrument or singer or choir. No, I don't think there's anybody I don't really like.
Okay, that's good. I told you a few months ago when I asked you if you wanted to post a negative review on the site, and you told me that you would rather if we kept that inside, and I understand that. I interviewed a movie director in 2020, and during that interview I learned what you actually said like a few seconds ago, that there's this collective contribution intent that we need to respect, and that's why even though I work with a lot of outlets, I try to stay away from being too harsh on films, because though they are the creations of people, and mm-hmm. I think that what I actually insist on when I write a negative review is when you feel like films are made by corporations. And I'm not talking about Disney or Amazon or things like that. It's just when you watch a film and you know that those films are made for the sake of saving a franchise or saving a few bucks for someone. I think that's the only time that when I allow myself to be harsh. And perhaps you don't agree with me or not, but I like your answer about film composers, because they have to be creative about something that will come from them. Okay, it's not like the DP, well, he has to photograph a certain scene and he has to play some lights in order to awake some sense of emotion or things like that. Films, music is like the creation of something towards contributing with emotions to something that that someone else has created. And I have to disagree with you, because I think that film composers own their music. I know that contractually they don't, but I like to think that I know that Dave Grossing's score for The Goonies is his and his only, for example.
Okay.
And I have another question. Is there a modern film composer that you found to be very interesting from the start? Like, I know I like what Trent Reznor does. I wanted to know what was yours.
Modern composer that I think was very interesting from the start. I think it could be probably Brian Tyler.
Yes.
I think he gives his film, his scores a real energy, a vibrancy, and you just don't get that sort of oomph without just being, I'm not gonna say that he's the he's like the understudy of Hans Zimmer, but just, I feel like that there's something he does. And this actually was something that goes back to what you asked earlier. What's a movie that I didn't like that the score was actually pretty well. My third choice is actually going to be Brian Tyler's Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles score, which is really good, even though
I don't remember that.
There's just something to it. I mean, it's very, I don't know if operatic is the way to describe it. I mean, I can think of the notes in my head right now and how it soars and it really takes your mind places. But the movie just didn't quite land. But just, you know, I've really liked his stuff from going back to The Killing Room and then working to sort of Now You See Me, Iron Man 3, which I think was one of the best things he's ever done. And then he's just gone on from there. Another one I think is go ahead.
Is it possible that he wrote the score for William Friedkin's Bug?
I think he did.
I think he did. Yes. And I love that score. Great.
And he just, I mean, almost he just surgery. Has a real talent. And I've never seen that, but that's with Michael Shannon and...
Yes, Ashley Judd.
That's right, yes. And I think he's just, I mean, he did Bubba Hotep. He did Six String Samurai. He did John Dies at the End. And I think he just has a real way to... He's sort of a self-made... genius in a way, I would say, because he does everything himself and he can play something like 40 instruments and, you know, he's really good at guitar. So I think that there's just something, I don't know, he's a rare breed. He's, you know, he's one of the biggest names out there. He's a superstar. The other one that I could think of, probably either Steve Jablonski or Harry Gregson-Williams. I've just always been in love with Harry's work and,
Okay, now you gave me an idea, because I love Jablonski's score for the remake of A Nightmare on Elm Street.
Okay,
and I don't like that film, of course, but I think his score is great. I mean, he has a piece like, I think it's called like Fred is Coming for You, that it's so creepy and it's so well written that I just like. Added to every single playlist that I have. And I think I haven't heard a lot from him. I think his work is mostly generic and it's adapted to the film you're watching, which is okay, of course. But I remember that score and it's great. So that was my answer to the previous question.
Okay, I'll have to put that on my list because I know he also did, the Friday the 13th remake as well, or yes, Texas, yes. And I think he got a lot of praise for that as well. But my I think he's really talented. We'll have a beer and talk over the term generic. But I think I know exactly what you mean when you say that. But I think my favorite of his to this day is still Steamboat. There's just something about that. It's the Katsushiro Otomo's film about a boy growing up in the 18th century England and how the world is changing with steam power. And so I think there's something about that. And it doesn't sound like anything else he's done. And I think when you go from that to Ender's Game and, of course, the Transformers series, and he even did the second Turtles installment. So that's kind of brings this conversation full circle. I mean, he's just got a... I mean, yeah, then that's kind of what I go back to before. I said, I don't think there's any composer that I don't have an appreciation for. And I think there was Alberto Iglesias's Exodus Gods and Kings film, the Ridley Scott film. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's really good, too. And even though the movie didn't quite know what to do with itself. But yeah, that's why I love film scores.
Okay, I have a couple of questions for you. I hope you don't mind me asking.
No, go for it.
I want to know who I'm working with. Do you have a top five list of films that you love? I mean, what are the best five films that you have ever seen?
The best five I've ever seen. That's a good one. I think the top of the list has got to be something like Life of Pi. That's one of them, just in terms of how sort of overpowering in a good way. Just, you know, the use of visuals and sort of fantasy elements and how it sort of went in and out of dream sequences, so to speak. Just it was so well done. I think The Matrix Reloaded, as odd of a choice as that was, I feel like that, you know, seeing The Matrix was a sort of life-changing experience. But while the second and third movies don't get the same love and appreciation, I think there's something about how the Wachowskis were able to take what they did in the first one and just give it, you know, give it 200 more horsepower, you know, take everything they did and just plus it. And not to say it worked, but just the sort of audacity of what you were seeing and all the everything that was thrown at you.
Okay, can we make a quick stop here?
Sure.
Do you find it appropriate to say that the three Matrix movies are just one large movie altogether?
I don't think so. I think that they could have stopped after one. I think to continue anything was basically turning it into a TV series. Which in some respect, if you use that thought process, it's kind of like what you said, it's one long movie. But I think that with everything, directors have a vision and they don't get it all in the first one. And so when they get a chance at the second one, they just try to take everything that they didn't get and go through their notes and their wish list and try to fulfill their vision posthumously. Or after the fact. I'm assuming you think that because you asked the question.
I don't assume it. I like to think it was made that way. I mean, just like I think that the Lost TV show was thought of like that from the beginning. I like to think that those guys knew they were going to end the show like that. With the Matrix films, I understand what you're saying. I know that they had a vision with the first one. And I think that part two and three, they're just fulfilling that. And that's why I like to think that they're all part of the same movie, the same story. I mean, it's just one story. And I think that I like to think of films that like a method for telling a story. And that's why I think it's like that. I mean, it's not the same as in, I don't know, Star Wars, because I think that every trilogy is very different from each other. But with The Matrix, I always think that they're just one large movie.
I'd buy that, yeah.
Yeah. Can you continue with your list, please?
Well, I'm glad you picked up on Signs, because that's another one that I just thought that was something that was so sort of mind-blowing, because, you know, after The Sixth Sense, everybody thought, well, you know, that was amazing. How do you top that? And then you see something like Unbreakable and you're wondering, where's a twist? What's this going to be? Where's a twist? And he still does it again, finding out you know, the heavy at the end of Unbreakable and the duality between the hero and the villain. And then when Signs rolled around, I kept thinking, at least in my mind, I kept thinking, is this an elaborate hoax? You know, are these really aliens? Is this just the McManus brothers or whatever those two brothers were mentioned in the film? I was like, the whole time you're sort of second guessing yourself and trying to figure out where it goes. And then just sort of the reveal at the end. And I think those three movies just all work in my opinion, the Life of Pi, Matrix Reloaded, and Signs. And then I'm gonna have to cheat here and turn around and look at my collection, but I think that I don't know, I think you could say sort of Inception is sort of the same mindset. You know it's such a palette expanding experience, you know, making you see how how wonderful a narrative can be spread in, you know, multiple layers, so that just when you think you're done, just when you've thinking, when you thought that a director could take something far enough, he goes another layer. Maybe Fantastic Mr. Fox, because I never thought something that was stop motion could be so compelling, but it's just, it's infinitely rewarding on every visit. And I just, I love that movie.
Well, I'm very embarrassed to say that I haven't seen that movie.
Oh, well, are you, I'm not a big Wes Anderson fan. I did not get Bottle Rocket or Rushmore or Tenenbaums, but that was the movie that sort of got me into the, okay, I think I get the appeal. And everything Fantastic Fox forward, I've been in love with. Everything prior than that, I don't get Wes Anderson. So,
yeah, I'm not a big fan. I think that his aesthetics are more important than the story, and that's something that I cannot negotiate with. I'm sorry. I think that he's overrated, in my opinion. I'm not a fan. I'm not a fan of nice images that don't tell you a story. And I found his stories to be like bland, even though I think the Grand Budapest Hotel was a great film. He didn't take himself very seriously. And that's what I love about the film. But I think that it was with Moonrise Kingdom that I just thought, well, this guy, I don't like him.
Okay.
And when there's a director whose movies I don't necessarily like, I try to stay away from his movies. I don't know, that's just my thing. It's the same with superhero movies. I don't like this whole Marvel and DC thing that's going on. I just think they follow a formula, and I'm not very interested in that.
Okay, it's like a roller coaster aesthetic versus a hearty meal with some substance. So
yeah,
that's fair enough. I can get behind that. I mean there are certain Marvel things I love, but I get the formula that you're talking about. But you know, what I really lose, what loses me, is that how, you know, comic books are, you know, there's so many stories out there, and they reinvent themselves, and then they retcon things, and then they just scratch everything and just say, well, this is, you know, forget all that. This is a brand new storyline. So the thing that I've tried to wrap my head around is that, okay, fine. Kevin Feige and the Marvel brand. Yes, I've sat through your 22 movies or however many to get to through phase 1, 2, and 3. Are we done yet? And, you know, when they come up with these TV shows, and then the TV shows are either a filler or a bridge for to get to the next phase, or, you know, like now they're celebrating B and C characters. I'm just going, when is enough enough? You know, I mean, I consciously stepped back and said, you know what? I just don't care anymore. I've given you 90 minutes, 15 times over, but I can't follow you down, you know, paths of TV just to sort of glean a couple things that may be tied to the universe. I mean, yeah. And I'm not saying that's wrong, because I know people eat that up, and, you know, I watched The Mandalorian. So I kind of am being a bit of a hypocrite in terms of, you know, like, and seeing the things that it ties to, but you know
but that's not a superhero TV show.
Oh no, but what I'm saying is that, you know, maybe the Mandalorian is more of a B character, and then all of the ties to the Star Wars universe, I'm using that as like a parallel to what's happening with Marvel. You know, you've got all these stories, all these characters that have tied to themselves anyway, but now you're having these offshoots and things just to sort of say, hey, we connect. And there's, you know, like if somebody with a S.H.I.E.L.D. t-shirt shows up, you're like, hey, that I think I know that guy, or whatever it is. So I don't know. I just think it's sort of that's quantity over quality, in my opinion. So I'd rather have a dense 180 minutes than, you know, string me out for 15 years. So.
Yeah. I think the same. I don't like how blind people have gotten over that exaggerated use of a machine that's just making things for money. And I try to share my arguments with fans, but I think that's a conversation that I won't start again. I mean, after last year, when I saw how Disney like reinvented themselves with all these TV shows and all these cartoon shows, it's over. It's a lost battle.
Yeah.
But I'm not one to condemn that, because I've always been in favor of horror movie franchises, and that they're the example of a great corporation that's just throwing around movies because they want to make money. It's just that I love them. that's why I criticize that part of our actuality, but I love horror film franchises, and I know that I can be blamed for the very same things that I'm criticizing.
Well, yeah, I mean, they just had 6 wrong turns before sort of, I guess, rebranding or starting all over again. Yeah. So now there's the 7th one, and now you talk about the Friday the 13th, or you know, the Halloweens. Now that it's sort of retconned all the other everything prior to 2018, and they said no, the 2018 one is the true sequel to Halloween, and now there's 2 more. So it's like, oh geez, and it's weird too, because you know, I had a conversation with somebody at a film festival, and they said that, you know, this sort of, you know, who gives the people the right, who gives anybody the right to say what you saw before doesn't mean anything? Like, for instance, if you're going to make a sequel to Casablanca, and you know, like, no, Rick Blaine was actually, he was an Australian, and he had nothing to do with the war. He just, you know, he lost a bet and his mortgage, like, okay, well, or something like, you know, one of my favorite movies of all time is Big Trouble in Little China. So if you make a sequel to that, which I know they're making a sequel, but if you stretch that into, you know, 5, 6, 7 features or a TV show, I think it would just lose its appeal. You know, I mean, there's something important about something being the one and only. And I just have to feel that, you know, go back to the Future. Originally, Back to the Future wasn't supposed to have a sequel. I think that they put the to be continued, and I might be wrong on this, I think they put those letters on when it went to TV. I don't think that was in the theater. And so that got people excited about the possibilities of a sequel. Now, do the sequels hold up to the first one? That's debatable. I know people who loathe Part 2, but they say 3 is actually quite good. I like them all kind of equally. But, you know, like, let's, they could have done, you know, and they did a TV show, or they did a cartoon show, and they did Part 4, which was a video game. So I think there are stories out there, but just if, are they necessary to tell? I don't think so. I think, you know, there's something interesting about something just being the, like, the one and only, or, you know, Godfather 1, people love Godfather 1, people love Godfather 2. I despise Godfather 2.
Why?
Because I wanted it to be more about young Vito. I didn't really care about Michael in Havana and him sort of growing his empire. I really wanted it to be more about how everything that made Marlon Brando's character Marlon Brando, especially giving more screen time to De Niro. And that's the other thing. You know, somebody presents you with their vision, somebody presents you with a product, and they put their heart into it. But sometimes if it's not what you're expecting, or if you wanted something different, well, does the fault lie on the creative, or does the fault lie on the consumer? In my, you know, my defense, I'm going to say it falls on the consumer. Or not my defense, I'm just going to say in my stance, it falls in the consumer. I wanted something different than what I got. Does that make it a bad product? No, but it significantly inhibited my enjoyment of it. So, but
yeah, that's what happens with the last Star Wars movies. I mean, they don't have to be made to fit a fan's expectation.
Mm-hmm.
And I know they're not perfect. They're not supposed to be perfect. But I think that this whole angst and hate towards those films, it blows my mind. Because if I were to create something or write a film, call it what you may, I would do it for myself,
mm-hmm.
not for someone who's expecting that. I'm not writing a love letter, even though some films feel like love letters. But coming back to the Godfather, did you see the Godfather epic?
Was that the Ford Coppola's re-envisioning of Part 3?
No, the Godfather epic is the three parts of Godfather, but they're chronologically edited to follow to be chronologically logical.
Oh, a linear storyline. Okay.
Yeah.
No, I haven't.
That's
haven't
interesting.
Seen that.
It doesn't work the same.
Okay.
I saw it when I was a very young boy, but perhaps that could work for you. And you wouldn't hate Godfather Part Two so much in that whole Havana part of the story. I like Godfather Part Two, but I think the whole Havana thing is enticing to me because I love Lee Strasberg. I love how that man performs. But I think that it cannot be compared to Godfather Part One in
sure.
that regard.
Sure.
There are two whole different pictures.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to ask, I think that you like Back to the Future a lot, right?
A bit. It's overrated. And no, of course. I love every bit of that, from obscure casting bits to the deleted scenes to all the stories and the sub characters. No, I think everything about that just works. And that's another story about how creative that I'm not the first person to say this, but I forget who said it first. They said, you make a movie three times. You make it when you write it, you make it when you edit it, and you make it when you edit it. So the idea is that there's so many creative hurdles to overcome, what works, what doesn't, the adaptation process, and just, you know, the having three different leads to play Marty and trying to figure out what works best and deciding, you know, sorry, Eric Stoltz, you're a great actor, but you're just not working. Or the original ending for the movie, which is supposed to take place at a like in a nuclear blast site. All these things that, you know, in some early concept were intended to be the story. The way what we got, I think, was exactly what we needed. And so, yes, I love all that. But go on with your question.
I like how it remains like this. I think it's one of the few franchises that it's immaculate to Hollywood. They haven't touched it again.
Mm-hmm.
And they wouldn't dare touch it. Well, so far. maybe you know, because if you love those films, but I think it was like 15 years ago, there was an advertising campaign made in Argentina with a store that's called Garbarino.
I think I've seen a video of this, but go on. Just like a YouTube clip, but go on.
Yeah, it all starts in a very famous avenue of here in Buenos Aires. And there's this blast, and like the DeLorean gets into the store and Doc comes out and says to the camera, oh, what year is this? That was a marketing campaign in which he remained in character for like, I think it was 1 or 2 months here in Buenos Aires. And he traveled from store to store, making apparitions in every store. In character.
No, I did not know this. I guess I never got the story of what that was all about, but.
Yeah, that's not documented in any place. When I moved here, I found the YouTube video and started researching a bit with people. And there are people who remember seeing him in the store. And he was like this lost old man who's dressed in white. And he doesn't speak a bit of Spanish. after that, they had to hold a press conference in breaking character because people were like concerned. Those of them that didn't know that that was a movie character, they thought that he was a madman that was really lost in the city.
So, oh man, glad nothing bad happened to him, or he ended up in the hospital or something. Yeah. Well, cool. It was an interesting question you asked some 10, 15 minutes ago about movies that really impacted you or some of the most original things you've ever seen. Do you have your five? I'd love to hear what you think.
Yeah, I have my five. My favorite film of all time is Terminator 2, Judgment Day.
Great.
That's my favorite film ever. I remember specifically the day I saw that film. I will never forget that day. And I like Spielberg. So I think that the best five films that I have ever seen are Psycho, The Exorcist. I think Close Encounters is just great. And Silence of the Lambs, and Schindler's List, which I hold very dear, but I don't think is. I know that the next time I've only seen it once, Schindler's List, and the day I saw it, it marked me. I think it was like a film event. But I told myself that I wasn't going to see that again in a few decades.
Mm, yeah.
Because it's not that it's violent. It's too emotionally gripping, and I don't like when films do that to me. And even though I think it's a masterpiece, I've only seen it in parts. After that, I haven't taken the time to see it from the start and just take it for the end. It's a film that I just can't. But those are my five films.
Wow. Well, I'm glad you led off with Terminator 2, because I was actually going to say sort of an honorable mention to my list was going to be Terminator 2, just because that's a movie that I saw Terminator 1 when I was younger. Again, thanks a lot to my dad, similar to, the things that your dad showed you. But then I was blown away at what you could do with a sequel, almost getting away with telling the exact same story, if you think about it, but getting to do it more overblown, more, and not overblown in a bad way, but just plussing every single element, taking it to, not just the next level, but, 10 levels beyond, and some of those scenes I watch again, like the helicopter scene or the part where the T-800 goes from the small rinky-dink pickup truck onto the semi-truck. And that's actually Arnold performing that stunt. Just, the level of balls that movie has. So, but flipping conversely, yes, to, Schindler's List, the number five on your spot. The first time I saw that was actually in eighth grade. We were learning about the Holocaust in junior high school. And we sat in an auditorium watching that movie. And we watched that, and that was
like a cautionary tale.
Exactly right. Exactly right. So it was pretty, pretty, pretty devastating. And I've seen it maybe once or twice since then, but you're right. The emotions are super high. I mean, just that end part when Oscar's taking that little lapel pin and he goes, I could have gotten one more person with that.
Yeah.
I mean, that just melts you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That breaks me every time I watch that. I think that's why I think that I was like very excited to watch I was 12 years old when I watched the film. And I was a fan of Jurassic Park, and it was the same year. And I actually told myself that it had to be fun. I didn't understand very well the difference between genres. But I remember watching that film and just being silent.
Because,
And I think that's the way everyone saw that. It's not a war movie, because it's not a war movie. It's history in film.
Oh, 100%. 100%. It is history, and it's important. I think that, and I think more to what the success of that is that it sticks with people, and it's important that these lessons stick, because exactly like you said, it's a cautionary tale, but it's a cinematic equivalent of a cautionary tale, but fantastic work all around. But I'd say we're getting to the end of the hour. Why don't we sort of round this up with some fun stuff, a little more getting to know Federico.
Yes.
You said you haven't seen many things recently, but you have sort of a list of things you want.
I saw the theaters here in Argentina, in Buenos Aires, I'm sorry, are not open. So I'm just sticking to VOD and streaming services. The last two movies that I saw that I really liked were Ben Wheatley's In the Earth. I like when Ben Wheatley sings, he made Kill List, which I think is a very important horror film, very important modern horror film. And after that, he made a film in England, which was like a very strange film.
Yeah, I did not like that. I think Ben Wheatley and I would not do well in a bar or at a restaurant. I don't know. Kill List? What's the one? The one where they're Kill in the warehouse. The warehouse. There's like a shootout at the end.
It's the one with a cult.
Hold on.
You're thinking of. What's the name of that film? Was it recent?
It was about 4 or 5 years ago. I'm actually going to look at that because, yes, I did like Killers. Free Fire. Free Fire is not for me. But yeah, Kill List was amazing, especially the ending of that. Wow. Impeccable movie. Eerie, just as bad as like Them, I think. The French movie Them.
Like Them, exactly. Yes. French film.
But go on. Yes.
I saw In the Earth. It was a film he made last year, and he made it during the pandemic. And I saw it as a cautionary tale about ecology or something like that. I don't know. I think it was very effective. The use of sound in that film is amazing. Amazing, the use of sound.
Mm.
And like 2 weeks ago, I saw a Mexican movie called New Order by Mexican director Michel Franco.
Okay.
I don't think I was prepared to see that film. It's a film about, I'm not going to spoil it or anything, but it's about a party that's going on in this very posh neighborhood in Mexico City. During this movie, this party, I'm sorry, we know that there are protests all around the city, and at some point, the people that are protesting arrive to the party, and of course, something happens, and the film has gotten a lot of criticizing because they are accusing the director of being racist or something like that. I really don't think he was being racist. I think he approached reality with a very poignant lenses. I really like that film. It's a heartbreaking film. It's very dark. It's very bleak. And I know that film will be talked about this year. It was released like, I think it was released yesterday in the States. So if you want to catch that on Amazon or something like that, just be prepared, okay? It's not an easy film. It's very violent. It's very disturbing. And it talks about a reality that that curiously in South America, it has happened in two countries here in South America.
Oh, really? Okay. So it is a cautionary tale.
Yeah. Mm. It is a cautionary tale. I like to think of it as extreme fiction because I don't think that what happens in the film would happen today. I mean, we don't know if it will happen today, but I like to think it wouldn't.
Mm.
Just watch it and tell me what you think. It's just be prepared. It's not an easy film to watch.
Yeah, you know, that's funny. I was having a discussion with a good friend of mine yesterday, and over the years, I've sort of come to this realization that, you know, just because a movie is great or fantastic or, you know, is so well done doesn't mean it has to leave you in pieces at the end of it. And I've sort of gotten away from movies that, even though they are just stellar or you know, some of the best ever, is it worth the price of admission just to say you saw it? And you know, something like Steve McQueen's Shame or Rob Zombie's The Devil's Rejects. And you know, they're both great in their own right. They both have a lot of things going for them, and they both do so much with the material. But just at the end of it, you just feel sort of drained, or you know, the fact that, you know, so people suffer so many injustices or horrific situations, and I just go to myself, you know, I've only got so much time left on the planet. You know, I'm a dad now. Do I really want to feel bad just to enjoy myself in the cinema? That's where, not to say I find myself going to like popcorn movies or you know, anything that's lighthearted, but I've just gotten to sort of that point in my life. But you know, that's just sort of my take on it, you know, seeing what I've seen. But I appreciate the recommendation. I'm excited to check out the things that you recommend. If you could, let's go back in time. If there's any movie that you wish you could have seen in the theater, I think you said you wish you could have seen Close Encounters.
Yeah, Close Encounters. Let me check. Wow, that's a Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Mm.
Yeah, you see that? I think that Raiders is a perfect film. It's perfect film, but it's not one of my favorite movies.
Interesting. Okay.
It's not one of my favorite movies. I think that my favorite movies are. I hold them like. I mean, close to my heart. I don't know how to say it, but. I think it's a perfect film, and it's not one of my favorites. It's like Halloween by John Carpenter. I think it's great. It's fantastic. And I would put it on my top 10 list. And it's not perfect, but I just like that movie so much. And I'm really sad that he didn't get to make more films. He just like plays music in concerts. I don't know. I would love to see him live. But I really, really think he should get back to making movies and not play video games every day.
Yeah, his big thing is if you want to do something, pay me. And you know, yeah. he did The Ward, which was sort of a by the numbers horror movie. You know, he only directed it. Unfortunately, I think that some people have their, I don't want to say he's peaked, because I think he has it in him, but there's just, you know, some people just sort of look at the world and they go, well, I think haven't I done enough? Or I think I've done enough. And I mean, I love Big Trouble, Little China and They Live. I even have a soft spot for something for not the whole movie, but parts of Starman. And yes, Halloween is great.
The Fog's great.
You know, I've never seen that, and I've
really.
I haven't. There's looking through. You know, a couple of weeks ago, I was looking through a list of
you know, everybody likes to do greatest Carpenter movies. And I was just surprised at how much I hadn't seen. So kind of.
Oh, so you haven't seen Prince of Darkness?
I have, but I didn't think that much of it. And
The same thing happened to me. I remember watching that film and thinking that I didn't like it. And to hear so much things about that movie, like the mix between science and technology and satanic stuff, I'm just like driven naturally towards that. I have to see that again. It's like when we, I don't know if you saw a Spanish film that's called Wreck. It's a zombie film.
I don't think so.
The found footage film Wreck.
Oh, right, as in record, yes, the first of four zombie movies by okay, gotcha.
So that film mixes like two subgenres very well, which is the satanic stuff with the zombie stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't understand how someone didn't think of it first, but I think that John Carpenter did that with Prince of Darkness. He mixed two subgenres so well, but I just didn't get that movie.
Yeah, I don't remember why I didn't like it. Please. But I just wasn't blown away by anything I saw. So maybe it was the content. Maybe it was because something like In the Mouth of Madness was great, and you know, The Thing is amazing. But there's other things like Ghosts of Mars and Vampires, which didn't just. I don't know. I guess sometimes, unless you just tread into sequel territory, I think some people just run out of ideas. You know, and I think for him to just, because no two movies are the same, which I think it's very difficult for any director to have that, to be able to claim that without jumping into things that are derivative or sequels. I mean, he's so across the board in terms of what he's produced. But it's just.
Yeah. Totally.
But, you know, now that we're back in, how are things where you are? Are people vaccinated? Are they still wearing masks? Is there a concern for health?
Today people are getting vaccinated, but at a very low rate. So I don't expect to be vaccinated this year because there's this whole politics situation where these guys are just, they didn't play early enough in the whole vaccine game. So they started reacting when they were desperate and the amount of cases was just exaggerated. I mean, we're today with like 35,000 positive tests every day, so that's a lot.
Really?
We're not on lockdown because you can actually get out during the day. I actually go around. I walk my dog, but that's it. I try to work out during the day, and that's it. People wear masks, not as religiously as I would like, but they do wear masks. The problem is that I'm only talking about my area of the neighborhood, and there are some poverty-stricken neighborhoods that don't behave the same. Mm. And law enforcement does not do their job. Like they should come up to people and say, please wear masks, please, social distancing or whatever, but they don't do their job. And I think people are tired. I mean, we've been this way like for a year.
Yeah, totally. And
how about you?
Texas is a bit cavalier in most situations, but thankfully, the one thing that we've had going for us is we have a little more land than other major metropolitan areas. So,
yeah.
You know, you saw tweets and Facebook posts of people who are, you know, even actors, you know, people who have a large following are locked in their house, and, you know, they're basically a prisoner in their
22nd story apartment or condo. It's a little different in Texas just because we have a little more real estate to sort of operate in. So it makes dealing with a pandemic a little easier. But I think we were one of the first to sort of roll back the not to say the mask, but more of the public outing. We were able to go out and do more. Restaurants opened sooner than other states. But now we're to a point where my daughter starts summer school on Tuesday, and it's she's had an entire year of wearing a mask as a kindergartner, and now she's now when they go to school on Tuesday for summer school, masks are optional. So vaccines are pretty in pretty high supply here, so people have been taking advantage of that, and theaters are now starting to open. So we're getting back to the way it was. But I'll read you this. Actually, I don't know if I want to read this, but I saw somebody tweeted something earlier. They did a, looks like a letterboxed review of Cruella, and the whole review.
Yeah, I read that.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
So the whole, yeah. whole thing is about, you know, people are now out to, you know, get back to society, and they just jump on each other like dogs and cats. It's like, have we learned nothing? Why is this the first thing we're seeing when we should be sort of embracing each other and high-fiving for the fact that we can now be in the same space and see movies together? It was crazy. So
what part of Texas do you live in?
I'm in Dallas. Okay. So we are kind of the northern part of the state.
Yeah. Okay. I've never been to Dallas. I mean, 3 years ago, we went on a trip and we went to Houston, and My parents lived in Dallas when I wasn't born yet, but I've always wanted to go there. But during this recent trip, we only went to Houston, San Antonio, and Austin.
Okay.
Yeah, that's what I know about Texas.
So what was your favorite?
I love San Antonio. I like the whole history thing that's very like present in the city.
Mm-hmm.
I liked how small it was. But I also loved about Austin. We went to this rodeo show and we loved it. And I just loved how on every corner there was someone like making music, which I love. I love that city. I'd always wanted to go to that city and be there. I like Stevie Ray Vaughan, so I wanted to know the city that he was born in.
Oh, great. I didn't know he was born in Austin. So that's you just taught me something about Texas. So thank you. well, great. Yeah, I was in San Antonio a couple of years ago. I think I've been twice. And you're right about the history. I was surprised at how sort of accessible everything was. So San Antonio is not as large as I imagined. I mean, for having a professional NBA team and just having a big presence, I was amazed to see that their footprint is not nearly as big as I expected. And just to find, you know, the Alamo is sort of in walking distance. It's so, you know, it's like a small town as opposed to a big city. Especially when you compare it to something like Austin or Houston, you know, with all this, you know, huge highway roads and, you know, state capital being in Austin or UT in Austin. So anyway, just sort of my takeaway, but I like that atmosphere.
Yeah.
But if you come to Dallas, I'll set you up with some places to go, and your first 17 beers will be on me. So
thank you so much.
Well, I tell you what, why don't we, you know, you were telling me some of the films that you loved and the experiences you had. What experiences are you going to have this weekend? Do you have anything planned and things you're looking forward to for the rest of the year?
Well, I don't think for the rest of the year, I don't think I'll be able to plan anything during this year because it's so, I don't like improvising. But the things that I can control, I like to plan with. So today, of course, I don't work in film writing, even though I do it like kind of professionally. I work in IT, and I really hate computers. yeah.
Interesting conundrum you're in.
Yeah, I think it's boring to be behind a computer all day. And this year, since last year, I started working on my brand. I'm trying to relaunch my site, which is screentology.com. And I started working with this designer, and she's also kind of like my mentor. And she mentioned some words that just got to me. And she told me, well, if you like writing so much, why can't you make a living off writing? So I started researching how I could make a living off writing. And I got to the copywriting thing. I didn't know what copywriting was. I didn't know it actually was something. And I started researching and, I don't know, checking my bank account and see if I could afford it to do this program with this. It's like a Spanish guru on copywriting. And two months ago, I decided I would give it a go. And today I'm becoming a copywriting to just try to, I don't know, make a living off writing. I think that I will stay in that mindset of changing my career during 2021. In the meanwhile, I cannot go out, I cannot travel because everything, I mean, we're on lockdown, and I cannot plan to do more stuff because I don't think I want to go somewhere without getting vaccinated. But if I have to go somewhere to get vaccinated and make that investment in a plane ticket, I'm going to do it. So I think that that's probably my priority right now, is just to stay put and try to take care of myself and try not to have contacts with the probable 35,000 people out there that have the virus. But that's it. I mean, I know that this will end at some point. I haven't seen the light at the end of the tunnel, sadly. But with this whole changing my career and relaunching my site and meeting fantastic people like you that like the same stuff that I like, I know that my life's going the right way.
Well, I'm glad to hear all of that, because I think the best thing you can do is have a vision or something that you want, and working towards that, even if it's slow steps or baby steps, it's still a step. So I applaud you for trying to pursue that endeavor. And yeah, one of the things I was going to ask you is that you were telling me sort of offline about your site's ambitions, and I didn't know if you were ready to describe it or talk about it anymore, but since you dropped the name, you want to tell a little bit more about it?
Yes. well, the truth is, I started writing on a website like 10 years ago. I didn't think at that time I would do it more. I don't think I would different that like a hobby or something like that. But last year, I made this decision that if I wanted to, I don't know, write a book or try to increase my presence in that field, I will have to decide on two things. I will have to change my language from Spanish to English altogether, because the audience is not the same. Everyone reads in English, not everyone reads in Spanish. And I would work on my brand, on my name. And ever since I made a decision, I started working on it. Today, I have this whole structure of the site itself. It's been coded as we speak. And I'm trying to include everything from film reviews to articles or anything that people want to write. I really would like people to write for my site. I know it's not, we don't make a living out of this. Of course, I cannot pay people to write for my site. It's for the passion of it. But I would like more female writers on these kind of outlets. I think that those are the voices that need to be present. And I've talked to some people to see if they want to write for my site. They're very fearful of what the end result could be like. And I'm just offering them my help and my assistance to for them to become better writers, even if it's like you said, like baby steps. But that's it. I'm trying to launch my site in 2 or 3 months. I'm trying to work on a podcast. That's why I bought the mic. And I started writing a podcast last year about Spielberg, where I would see a Spielberg movie and write this whole analysis of the film. It didn't get to anything because I had to make a decision if I wanted to increase my presence during a rebranding of my site. So that's why the mic was just gathering dust. I know that I will get around to do it at some point, but just not right now. I really want to go with my site because I'm so excited that it has this whole like look and feel, or I don't know. I really put my heart to it, and I don't know. I think it's just like my baby. I just want to get around to see work. Hopefully it will turn out to be great.
Well, having a baby myself, Go See Talk is something that I just can't seem to not put my time in, even though it makes no money and, you know, very, very difficult to find somebody to write. So, which is why I was so surprised to get your email and happy to give you a platform in any manner to continue writing or find a voice or just, you know, try another outlet. But I think what we'll do is we'll hit the pause button on this. Love your content on the site. Until that time, I guess we will, as they say, see you at the movies.